Chapter 24 of The Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 24. The letters that Oscar Wilde wrote to me at this time began, as I have stated, in a lecturing and fault-finding tone, which, for all my desire to be reconciled with him, I was not disposed to go on standing for long. I replied vigorously, and pointed out that his attitude towards me was unfair and ungrateful, that it was quite unworthy of him, and that it appeared to reflect the psychological results of his imprisonment in a way which he would probably soon grow out of when he had got back the full use of his brains and intellect. The result was that Oscar soon dropped his fault-finding attitude. His letters became more and more affectionate, and he made no secret of the fact that he was longing to see me again, and that it was only the necessity, chiefly for financial reasons, of keeping in with certain people, including, of course, Ross, who was apparently holding a great part of the money subscribed for Oscar, and doling it out from time to time, that prevented him from rushing over to Paris to see me, or asking me to stay with him at Berneval. I may say, to prevent misunderstanding, that I do not blame Ross at all for his cautiousness about the money, and for his, unfortunately fruitless, efforts to make it last a little longer than it did. In this respect, he certainly acted entirely in Oscar's interests, and with the best motives. I must here emphasise what I have said before in this book, that the letters which Oscar wrote me at this time, even allowing for the fact that I later destroyed many of those which contained the most exaggerated expressions of affection and devotion, completely dispose of all the nonsense of his wild accusations against me in the unpublished part of De Profundis. Between the time when he penned this violent diatribe and the time when he wrote me these adoring letters, nothing whatever had happened in relation to our friendship, except that he had got out of prison. If I was such a bad friend, and so unworthy of the great love I showed you, at the time he was spending his last months in prison, why did I now become his comfort and joy, his only hope for the future, and his own darling boy? It is to be observed that when he wrote these letters, he had not seen me for nearly 2 years, so that the disturbing and disastrous effects on him attributed to my presence and personality by Harris, Ross, Sherard and others had had no chance of being exercised. The real truth is, unpalatable as it may be to Ross and Sherard and Harris and any other living person who could be named at that time, that Oscar cared more for my little finger than he did for all the rest of these persons put together body and soul. It cannot be contended, either, that his devotion to me was a mere physical infatuation, because the facts, even according to my great enemy and detractor Frank Harris, are admitted to be that I was, alone of those I have mentioned, not only the dearest friend of his bosom, but his intellectual peer. Harris cannot have it both ways. It is idle for him to endeavour to make out, as he does on one printed page, that I was a kind of, Troilus and Cressida, Patroclus to Wilde's Achilles, as interpreted and commented on by the foul-mouthed Thersites, when, on another printed page, he compares my sonnets to Shakespeare's, and declares unhesitatingly that even in my extreme youth I was always a far better poet than Wilde himself. As I believe in giving credit where it is due, even to those who have most grievously wronged me, and Harris has no excuse at all for his treatment of me, for I was for many years his intimate friend, and he once did put me out of £2,000 without losing my friendship or hearing any reproaches from me. I may say that I think it is really wonderful that he should have committed himself as strongly as he has done to appreciation of me as a poet and man of letters. At one time he knew many of my sonnets by heart, and used to recite them in his well-known sucking dove roar in restaurants and other public resorts. Seriously, his rendering of them was calculated to delight their author's heart, for he was and is now an accomplished reader or reciter of poetry. His charming and accomplished wife told me that at one time, when he wanted to give the highest praise to any work of art, he used to say, "It's as fine as one of Alfred Douglas's sonnets." It is then certainly to Harris's credit that his desire, for reasons best known to himself, to blacken my character and hold me up to public contempt and reprobation, has not prevented him from expressing his honest opinion of my merits as a poet. Unless, indeed, it be that this apparent honesty of opinion is only a clever device to lend more strength to his denunciations. As who should say, "You observe how fair I am, though I am obliged in the interests of truth to attack Lord Alfred Douglas's character, I would not dream of denying him any credit that he deserved as a poet and man of brains and intellect." I prefer to think that Harris really did feel that in his denunciation of me he must draw the line somewhere, and that his literary conscience, being, like Oscar Wilde's, more sensitive than his moral conscience, did not permit him to speak falsely about my poetry, even if he had no scruple in deliberately lying about my character and about facts well known to him in regard to my relations with Wilde. Footnote: to accuse a man of downright deliberate lying is a serious thing to do. I was willing enough to accept, without questioning it, whatever my private thoughts were, Harris's explanation that it was Ross who was responsible for misleading him and falsifying the facts. But as he has now repeated his libels in a new edition of his book, and reiterated them in an introduction of a cheap edition of De Profundis, published by the Modern Library in New York about a year ago, I can think of no other words to apply to what he has done but deliberate lying. Listen to what he says about me in the new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde. "That I should have misjudged the foremost poet of this time is my keenest regret. That I could have believed that such noble gifts could go with corrupt meanness of character shows the malignant cleverness of his detractors." These are the words with which he finishes his preface, and yet, within a year, he is republishing the book containing all his false statements and misrepresentations, and writing a fresh batch of them as an introduction to a new book. End of footnote. After Oscar and I had exchanged about half a dozen letters, he wrote and definitely invited me to come and stay with him at Berneval. In a characteristically playful epistle, he suggested that it would be advisable that I should assume some other name for the occasion. He said in his letter that he had been thinking of a suitable name for me, and was divided between Le Chevalier de la Fleur de Lys and Jonquil du Vallon. In another letter, he informed me that he had decided that I was to be Jonquil du Vallon, and referred to himself as "that strange purple shadow who is known as Sebastian Melmoth," which was in fact the name he adopted after he came out of prison, and by which I addressed him on the envelopes of my letters. All this, though it may now sound rather childish, was just like the old Oscar whom I had known and loved before the catastrophe. I was just getting ready to start when a telegram arrived stopping me and telling me to await a letter. The letter arrived and contained a story that he had been warned that it would be dangerous for me to come, as my father was having him watched, and would, certainly, intervene and create a fresh scandal. This, of course, was a pure canard, but no doubt he believed it. He lamented the impossibility of our meeting in moving terms, but declared that his devotion to me was only enhanced by our continued separation. I wrote back, laughing at the idea of my father's supposed plot, and suggesting that we should meet somewhere else. He replied that he would not come to Paris, as he could not face Paris yet, but suggested Rouen. So we agreed to meet at Rouen, and did so, for one night and day, at the Hôtel de la Poste, where I had stayed before and was known. This made the assumption of an assumed name on my part impracticable, which I really think was a cause of great disappointment to Oscar. The meeting was a great success. I have often thought since that if he or I had died directly after that, our friendship would have ended in a beautiful and romantic way. Poor Oscar cried when I met him at the station. We walked about all day, arm in arm or hand in hand, and were perfectly happy. Next day he went back to Berneval, and I returned to Paris, but we had settled that when I went to Naples about 6 weeks later, he was to join me there. About a week later I went to Aix-les-Bains with my mother and sister. I stayed there about 5 weeks and had a most delightful time. While I was there I wrote the Ballad of St. Vitus, which I consider to be the best of my three ballads. My mother then went back to London, and I went on to Naples, meeting Oscar on the train from Paris. We went to the Hotel Royal, and I celebrated the occasion by running up a bill for £68 in the fortnight we were there. This bill remained unpaid right up to the time when I left Oscar at Naples, about 2 or 3 months later, when my dear mother sent me £200 to give to Oscar, and also the money to pay the hotel bill and enable me to get back to Paris via Rome. I must explain that the proprietor, or manager, of the Hotel Royal, being of course under the usual impression that obtains, or used to obtain, on the continent, that an English lord is invariably a millionaire, seemed quite undisturbed by my request that he should let the bill stand over. He expressed himself enchanted to oblige me, and beyond sending in the bill again after about 2 months, he made no kind of demonstration. I would not have the cheek to do a thing like that nowadays, but in the year 1897 I still lived under the pleasing illusion that life more or less belonged to me, and that money was not a thing to take seriously. While we were at Naples, Oscar finished the Ballad of Reading Gaol, and I wrote the four sonnets called The City of the Soul, my Sonnet on the Sonnet, and A Triad of the Moon. About a year before, I had spent some months in Rome with my mother, and I there had the pleasure of meeting, for the first time, my dear old friend Harry de Wint, whose friendship to this day is one of my most valued possessions. Harry and I met in the bar of the Grand Hotel. He had known my father intimately for years, and also other members of my family, and he spoke to me directly he knew who I was. Where he was engaged for several hours in an argument, which frequently threatened to culminate in bloodshed, with an exceedingly tough gentleman from the colonies. What the argument was about I cannot now recollect, but the tough gentleman from the colonies, who claimed to be, and really was, I afterwards found out, a bosom friend of my brother Percy's, several times reached for a gun which he carried in his back breeches pocket. The discussion went on with varying degrees of ferocity, alternating with friendly interludes when drinks were offered and accepted, till 3:30 in the morning, at which hour a truce, due to sheer exhaustion on the part of all concerned, was called, and the meeting broke up. Harry saw me back to the rooms where I was living with my mother. I then saw him back to the Grand Hotel. The process was repeated several times, and it was broad daylight when we parted. A few months afterwards, I met our colonial friend at Monte Carlo, where, hearing that I had just lost all the money in my pocket, he generously lent me 25 louis and insisted on entertaining me sumptuously at dinner at the Hôtel de Paris. He referred in feeling terms to Harry, who, according to his account of the affair, was a man to whom he had immediately felt irresistibly drawn by magnetic attraction at first sight, and who had reciprocated the feeling in the strongest way. I saw him a week later, when, I am glad to be able to state, I paid him back the 25 louis, for the next thing I heard about him was that he had committed suicide. I cannot remember the poor fellow's name. Harry de Wint turned up at Naples while Oscar and I were there. He knew Oscar well, and admired his work and his conversation. We dined together in a café, and I afterwards happened to go away and leave them together. Harry de Wint told me years later that when he read the accounts of the ransom trial in the papers, he was amazed and disgusted to read the letter which Wilde wrote to Ross, in which he describes how I left him at Naples. As soon as there was no money, he left me, says Wilde in this abominable letter, and the rest of the letter, which is reproduced in Harris's Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, is in the same strain. No mention is made in it of the £200 I gave him. Harry told me that while I was away, Wilde's conversation with him was one long eulogy of me, and of how I had stuck to him through thick and thin, and was his best and most faithful friend. Harry told me that if he had known about the ransom action, he would have been pleased to come and give evidence on this point. I described in detail in Chapter 14 how I was forced to leave Oscar in Naples, because my mother, when she found out that he was with me, immediately wrote to me and said that unless I left him, she would discontinue my allowance. What possessed Oscar to write this disgusting letter to Ross, which I read for the first time 14 years later, I cannot even conjecture. As Harris says in the preface, "Such hypocrisy and falsehood are hard even to understand, but the facts remain." Oscar and I were fairly happy at Naples, though we had several quarrels. He had nothing beyond an allowance of £3 a week from his wife, and I had very little money, only about £8 a week. The constant worry about ways and means was trying, and Oscar did not adapt himself as easily as I have always been able to do to making the best of a small income. All the same, we were still great friends, and when my mother's ultimatum came as a bombshell to break up our association, we were both very distressed. Obviously, however, there was nothing for it but for me to leave him. We were neither of us in a position to raise a penny, and it was merely a question of getting enough money to carry Oscar on till he could get more from some other source. I left him in my villa with 3 months' rent paid in advance. With ordinary care, the £200 I got for him would have kept him in Naples, where everything was amazingly cheap, in comfort for at least 5 or 6 months. I had lived myself on less money for as long a period in France, without complaining. But as a matter of fact, Oscar remained only a few weeks in Naples. He then went to Paris. End of Chapter 24.